You're listening to Munch, a podcast and website where we pair meals with movies. I'm Ben.
I'm Andre.
I'm Leanna.
And this week, we're here talking about Great Expectations, which is my birthday Super Munch post. And we have none other than friend of the podcast, Francis Chim, joining us for this journey, this visual and...
sensory?
There's a sense already.
There's a couple senses in there. Mm-hmm. Joining us. Francis, thank you for joining us on this film.
Thanks for having me for, I think, third time? Yes.
This would be
Harry Potter and...
Tokyo Drift.
Oh, that's Tokyo Drift.
Good one. Drift, so good. Mm.
Still thinking about Han's hair.
Yeah.
Who isn't? Really? I'm not. I'm still thinking about it.
It's really good. It's solid hair. Mm-hmm. Just
but
imagine,
not,
like
literally
what,
solid, but like
yeah. I'm just. I want to know what it feels like
To run your fingers through it.
No, to have the hair, have that hair on your head, and then run your fingers.
Ooh.
Like it's a different reaction, like it being your own hair versus someone
you
else's
get,
hair, and
that,
also like
yeah.
there's the whole
yeah.
thing of like, just don't run your hand through other people's hair.
Yeah. With that. Yeah. No.
With a whole another component to that. And, but
it's
like, there's your
enthusiastic consent, which we'll talk about later.
Yes, oh, we will.
Sure,
yes.
Yes,
we
for
will.
Sure will. But like, imagine running your hand through your own hair and having it be that like silky smooth.
I
imagine. I
almost feel like
cool.
it would be like air. Like you wouldn't even feel it. It would just.
And it just like falls back into place.
Like for those of you who are just listening, which is everyone, I think we all just collectively touched our hair because we were
like... those of you who are just listening, like I like this idea that this is like a live podcast.
Yeah.
And
call in if you just touched your own hair. Tell us what it was like.
Long time listener, first time caller.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Great Expectations. which we all had some expectations about, very different expectations, some no expectations. But let's start this off by talking about our idea of how we constructed the food as a whole and kind of the core thought behind what we went after here, which was like pretty straightforward and simple based on how this film presents color throughout its entirety. It is one of the few films that... is very clear in the colors it wants to denote, and it fills every single scene it can with
green.
Yeah, green. So we took that very easy
Seriously?
And simple prompt and just went forward with it and made every dish as green as we could and every shot we took as green as it could.
We had a lot of fun with it, and we all wore green today.
Yes.
We did.
I think we were all very on point in terms of our color scheme and how we would have fit perfectly into the film.
Yes.
We could have been extras on that film.
Literally.
Mm. So go to getmunchedup.com to view the photos and how they turned out.
Or go to Twitter and see the outfits we wore. Like,
also really good.
Check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
which
yeah,
is at getmunchedup. But I think across
Are
the
we already
board,
closing out?
No, but...
and?
Not everyone listens to the
okay.
end, Andre. All
right, well, they should.
We need to hit them earlier on.
Okay.
Like, you bookend it so that they get that information early on and at the end.
The best marketing
okay.
is based on repetition.
Yeah,
okay.
the more
yeah.
they hear
okay.
it, the more they're thinking about it, the more they like it.
Impressions.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same with the green in the movie. It's just, you know...
Yep.
Yeah.
It keeps hitting.
You
gotta
beat the audience over the head with the themes.
Mm-hmm. I get it. At Get Munched Up.
Yeah. So
Twitter,
the photos
Instagram,
look great,
Facebook.
Or the photos are going to look great. I can tell they are going to look great.
They
I haven't edited them yet. Spoiler alert! But
you
I
took them.
Yes, I took them, and I'm happy with how they have turned out so far.
It's that natural summer lighting.
It is that natural summer lighting. Scout has some thoughts about that natural summer lighting as well.
Yeah, I'm not a big
she
fan.
Was like, hey, it's dark outside. I need to go outside.
It's past her bedtime.
Yeah.
She's upset.
Well, what actually happened was the cat walked in front of her. And
it's been a long day for her.
Yeah.
It's interesting the fact that it was the first day of rain in 56 days.
Mm.
Could be that. Who knows? Our dog has a lot of thoughts on a lot of things.
Yep.
She's a complex creature.
She is.
Thank goodness.
You know who else is a complex creature?
Ethan Hawke.
It could be any number of characters.
Literally
like, yeah, like, oh, where are you going with that, Leanna? What a great segue.
Where are you going with that?
I was going to say Estella, but...
Oh, okay.
I think that's a great place to start this off.
Where did she learn French?
again, something we'll get into, but I think it's the idea of how richness is passed on, and in America, that idea of richness is passed on through language and understanding. Not to pull up that David Brooks column a couple weeks or months ago about how one of his friends didn't know what like Capricola was, but I think the idea of let's just open this up to the idea of richness, get it out of the way, and how this film deals with wealth and perceived wealth and wealth being thrust upon you, and how there's the difference of the rich and kind of the nouveau riche, similar to how The Great Gatsby talks about it, which I'm sure there's some connections there as well, which we have talked around over the course of this night.
All I was missing was that green line at the end. Mm-hmm. That would have been so much other green, though.
That's the true green line.
I thought it was, like, the film definitely doesn't make you guess that that's something they want you to think about. It's pretty obvious. The fact that the home in which Finn grows up in is so dilapidated and it looks like he lives in this shanty town, and mm-hmm. it's very obvious that he doesn't come from any money at all.
And even how the characters react to $500 and how they are willing to almost pawn off their brother in a certain way as a means to get more of that money, which isn't necessarily a great view of those that do not have money, and which is like an unfortunate and like muddies this film's idea and maybe thesis on what wealth versus and those that have versus those that have not actually tries to get across. I mean, I think that is true about how this film deals with any kind of themes. It's very messy across the board, and I don't think it truly hits at anything. And that's probably one of the biggest downfalls with this film, is it is never solid in the ideas and thoughts that it wants to get across.
Yeah, like there's a scene in particular that stood out where Finn finally makes it and has his big art exhibition, and mm-hmm. his... Oh man, I don't really know what his like official relation is.
Uncle Joe?
Uncle, yeah.
Yeah, but it's more just like his sister's
boyfriend? Brother-in-law. Like kind of a brother-in-law, but yeah. They were never married.
Yeah.
But he comes to the event and embarrasses him because he accidentally hits a like tray of champagne, and he's talking loudly and talking
Finn has lied about him dying of an overdose to make the story more tragic.
Yeah. Mm. But at the same time, it kind of felt forced in that through every other scene that we'd seen, Joanne had made him kind of endearing. Like he was this like father-ish figure for Finn, and he seemed like a good guy, and he tried to connect with him, and they had inside jokes. And then they have this scene where they're trying to juxtapose Finn's rise into fame and money and this guy who still doesn't have any of that, but he was still trying. Like he had the bow tie and the tuxedo and everything. It felt really forced. And so
it came so fast. It felt like it happened really fast.
Yeah. And
yeah,
I get what they were going for, but it didn't feel like they built the foundation for that scene to actually work.
Right.
And so
in that scene, you just had to accept that now Finn is full of himself and too good for
I would disagree and say they set that up. Like there's a very clear connection between a single woman / journalist who is in both of those scenes. Mm-hmm. And they set you up earlier on with that idea of like, he is starting to be, like the wealth and the idea and how this has been thrust upon him and given to him without any reason behind it, and the privilege that he has, to just be accepted into all of this.
It wasn't Finn who I didn't believe. It was the, like
Joe?
Yeah, it was a script and the performance they made Joe give. It felt wrong. It felt like he was trying to be like a caricature of himself. I have a theory about this.
Oh, let's hear it.
Okay.
All right.
Is this your fairy theory?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Cool. We're getting into this now.
All right. So I can wait to get.
No, I want to.
No. Okay, I'm in.
This is.
I think this is a really interesting theory, and I could totally see there being enough film evidence in this film to back this theory up.
I feel the last time I was on the podcast, I talked about my belief in Han's bisexuality, what's his face is the American. Generic bros bisexuality.
Sean Boswell's bisexuality.
I'm establishing myself as the keeper of crackpot theories. When you have me as a guest on this podcast.
I'm so into this. From now on, when we introduce Francis, can we be like, and we've got our friend Francis, the keeper of crackpot theory.
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, I would not protest.
It could be a segment, crackpot theories with Francis.
To establish the scene for folks that have not seen this movie, in the beginning we have like a child actor who looks a lot like adult Ethan Hawke.
A lot, actually.
Yeah, like well, very good casting in that respect. Like essentially pawned off by his sister and her boyfriend to go play with the granddaughter of this wealthy woman who's supposedly ancient, but looks like she's 60 years old, and lives in this, like, decrepit mansion that's covered in, like, dead and dying vines and other plants. So my crackpot theory, the cat just, like, opened a little cat door with his paw. Yeah, it's really very cute. Right?
He's good at that. He's a smart boy.
Yeah, he's a very smart boy. Anyway, my crackpot theory, primarily based on like the general youthfulness of the actress that was supposed to play the grandmother, who's allegedly ancient, was that she is a fairy rejected from the fairy realm. Mm. So in traditional fairy stories, you have the Seelie and the Unseelie court. The Seelie being the quote-unquote good and Unseelie being the quote-unquote evil. But no fairies are good based on, like, human morality. So they all want something from you.
What does she want?
Well, I don't quite know. Okay. I think she wants...
She's not given enough time to truly
share. Yeah, we did not see enough.
Unless her want is to meddle in the affairs of men and human beings.
I think my two theories are that she wants validation for her granddaughter... Or, as we see at the end of the film, she wants her granddaughter to have, like, a half-human child.
Half-human?
Yeah. But to, like, if Gwyneth Paltrow is also a fairy.
Oh, okay.
But so, the, like, decaying decadence of this mansion kind of, like, adds to my theory that they're all fairies.
It felt very like Secret Garden or Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
There's something whimsical about the way she moves and talks. Mm-hmm.
And how she didn't age. Like, as everyone else aged in the movie, she stayed exactly the same. Except for that last scene. I wanted to know your thought, how that plays into the theory.
I think, like, his fairies use, like, a magic called glamour to disguise their horrendous appearance, because most fairies actually do not look very beautiful. But also in fairy stories, like recurring across cultures, is you don't want to eat or drink anything when you're in the fairy realm, and Ethan Hawke drinks from the fountain when he's a child, and if you eat or drink anything in the fairy realm, you're kind of like in their thrall and like owe something to them.
That would make a lot of sense.
Yeah,
so that would make a lot.
Because as soon as he drinks the water, he's, like, kissed by the young Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, yeah.
So that could be, like, the water, you know, the water kissing him and entrancing him. Or as soon as he drinks the water, he's not safe anymore.
Well, yeah, as soon as he drinks the water, he owes something to the fairies. They've, like, they've given him something. Maybe that's the waters of inspiration.
And it's almost like he breaks out of that spell for a little bit, but
then
halfway through the movie, though, there's another like fountain kissing scene. So he and that's almost the shift in the movie where he falls back into that spell really obviously, and it kind of brings about the second arc of the film.
I like that.
Like, I do want to, like, I have a couple of thoughts about this. One, Andre, you mentioned how they always have an establishing shot of Paradiso Perduto, which is
the same establishing shot every time, like the same like sunbeam.
Yeah, which like translates to Paradise Lost. John Milton's poem about kind of like Adam and Eve and the idea of love and how Satan falls into all that and things like that. And I think it's like there's also components about being human and non-human within that component. So mm-hmm. I think in a weird way that works to this movie's effect and to Francis's theory.
Thank you for feeding into my crackpot-tude.
It's not crackpot-tude. But I think you might actually be on something because the only reason they would establish that so many times is because, hey, pay attention to this and begin to understand why I'm showing you this scene over and over again. And every time you go into those moments where there's decrepitude and it's run over by plants in wildlife, there's a sense of wilderness there and kind of lack of humanity, and all this leads to kind of two sides, which is that fairy that we talked about, that older grandmother being one side and representing one side of the coin, perhaps non-humanity, and then humanity being represented by the Robert De Niro character or the
You thought he was a fairy too?
No, he is specifically the human side.
I see.
And those, the human and the non-human, are at odds in this film.
Yeah,
and ultimately clash.
Kind of has like a debt to both of them.
Yeah.
In a weird way.
Which ultimately leads us into the idea of him trying to fawn over this fairy-like character, but also while still being lifted up in human society, and the conflict that causes within his life. While ultimately the human side of him is killed off at a certain point and he finally reunites with the non-human side of him, mm-hmm. it is not necessarily at a pleasant means because he realizes that the human side of his life that was built up is ultimately a hoax and he has no control over it, where the fairy side of it feels a little more natural, feels a little more kind of willful and based off of the actual interests and likes of both those characters.
And in a weird way, the only time we see a human side of Gwyneth Paltrow's character is at the very end,
mm-hmm.
when she has this possibly half fairy, half human child.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
totally Ethan Hawke's
in
kid.
It has to be.
100%.
And the mansion is like decaying to such an extreme, like far beyond what it did in any
yeah.
other.
Like they even show the roof caved in
yeah,
and you
yeah.
can see the human sky beyond that. And I think all this in a weird way gets back to kind of what started us on this conversation of the movie itself, which was Gwyneth Paltrow's character, Estella, and how she is presented as this strong, relatively capable, but like fluctuating being that is understanding of her wants while conflicted by it at the same time. And she is often shown as someone who is in control of her sexuality and what she wants out of the scene, offering up her leg in moments while also inviting the gaze of a man onto her as well. And also reaching to that kind of like very clear, like, yes, I want this. And I feel like in a way there is like that, this fairy component, because you often don't see women depicted like this in
especially not in 1998.
Yeah.
We watched a lot of older movies,
film
and
novels. And so it does feel refreshing. And I wonder if they're using that as a means to show her as being a non-human like character and being a fairy, because there's often in folklore and lore in general the idea of a siren or calling to a man.
She is a
and
muse.
Pulling
yeah.
yeah
taking him out of his hometown to this distant place where he's not safe and similar to
how mermaids are, which are often depicted with like green scales and things like that.
Robert De Niro for sure. So
earlier in the film,
because he was in the water,
he has unlimited breath.
Yeah,
and okay. Just stay underwater.
I think we can all agree that he was the token merman. Mm-hmm. So
that was okay.
All this is to say that I think Francis. Your theories are actually pretty
good. It's actually really good. I like it. It's a good read.
Like,
I like it a lot.
We dove deep, and I think it actually works as we look at the film as a whole and a lot of the components
within it. One of the things that's, as flawed as this film is, one of the things that's interesting about it, even if we ignore my fantastical crackpot theory, I do enjoy that, like, Gwyneth Paltrow's character hits a lot of the beats of a traditional manic pixie dream girl, but it's also very obvious that she's controlling every one of those beats. So it's, like, an artifice that she's creating, which I feel like a lot of other movies of the time, the manic pixie dream girl characters are much more aloof and unaware of themselves.
Yeah,
and
this reminded me a lot.
Very aware of herself.
This reminded me a lot of 500 Days of Summer. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think because we watched that for my last birthday movie, and I don't know. Like, I got really tired of the because I loved 500 Days of Summer when it first came out. And so that's why I wanted to watch it later as an adult, because I thought that I would still enjoy it, and I didn't, because I found the, like, manic pixie dream girl stereotype to be infuriating and really frustrating to watch, especially with Zooey Deschanel, where it's been kind of played out for her specifically.
Mm-hmm. And I would also say that Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, like, doesn't go any further to, like, build on what a great... like, how those characterizations ultimately work.
But this movie had to be an inspiration for 500 Days of Summer, right? Because Joseph Gordon-Levitt is also an artist of sorts. Like, there's that whole scene where he draws on her arm, and he draws on that chalkboard behind his bed, and he, like, finds his way back to architecture and everything.
Yeah.
In both movies, the thing that I find interesting watching it now as an adult is that I could see myself, like, this is my first time seeing Great Expectations, but I could see myself, if I had seen it when I saw, around the time I saw 500 Days of Summer, which was in high school, I would have identified more with the male character and thought to myself, oh, this poor boy, he just wants to be with this girl, and she keeps leading him on and won't give him, like, he seems so good and he just wants to be there for her, and I would ignore, like, all the faults and expectations of the male character. And it's just, it's funny to me to watch it now as an adult and be like, oh, it's actually totally fine that she's just gonna, you know, have a power walk out and be like, nope, I'm done. See you tomorrow. Yeah. Or I'm going to Europe actually for 2 years. Sorry, bye. That's totally fine. It's her choice and that's her move. And
well, I had kind of a different read on the whole movie and all the characters in this movie. Okay, let me back it up. At the very beginning of the movie, Ethan Hawke in his voiceover says, I'm not going to tell the story how it happened, but how I remembered it happening. So all of these characters in the movie aren't, they're just how Ethan Hawke remembers the characters being. So he remembers this woman in the decrepit house always looking the same because in his memory, that's how she always looked. And then one day he realized that she had gotten older.
So
he's
ultimately an unreliable narrative. Mm,
yeah,
exactly.
That's a good point.
And Gwyneth Paltrow was always like right on the cusp of being there and then disappearing. So it was just like his kind of unreliable memories of, he remembered this house was like old and run down, but it wasn't really overgrown with vines. So,
and maybe they ultimately didn't end up together with a potential child in tow.
Right. Or there's other parts where he shows up in New York and he tells the lawyer and the journalist to spin a story around him being from Florida, and like that's him telling himself that he's creating that own narrative around him And, like, he built this fame up for himself, and it was all his idea. But this is really just him not remembering things exactly as they happened, but how he remembered them.
I almost wish they'd played into the unreliable narrator bit more, because they introduce it early on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, I was reading an article recently, or watching a video about how a camera can depict unreliability and how that subjectivity can be built in and how they shoot specific shots.
Mm-hmm.
And in watching this film, I didn't necessarily notice anything very specific in how they were shooting moments outside of, like, when he has the ladybug on his finger and things like that, and looking at how the depth of field is used. So, like, I totally agree that, like, they should have leaned into it more if
mm-hmm.
this is actually a scenario in which the narrator is unreliable. But I think this is also, like, hitting at the larger issues of this film in general, in that mm-hmm. it doesn't truly... It's a mess of ideas that you can put your own meaning to in weird ways.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of craft your own narrative about how these yeah. characters interact and
I think
what
that's
the,
like,
larger message yeah. is.
That's how I'm justifying it. It didn't make a whole lot of sense, so I'm thinking, okay, he didn't remember it correctly.
Yeah.
Like, this is his own kind of twisted
take
on what happened.
I feel like we're being pretty critical, but I did actually enjoy this film.
Yes. Totally. Like, I was afraid, as we have been with a lot of films for Munch, where we enjoyed it when we were younger, and coming into it, we find out that we don't actually enjoy it. But my experience with it this time was, like, it has those, like, very impactful moments, and it knows how to use music at its time. It's very well shot, and the structure of the story of having building intrigue from the beginning, spending enough time to allow you to forget it, and then pull it back as a almost trick to your experience of the film as a whole is interesting. And I think there's a lot to talk about, which has really opened us up for the conversation of how this film is structured and all the themes and moments in this film, because there's a lot of them. And so I recognize that it's messy in how it delivers those themes, but I mm-hmm. think I ultimately enjoy it and how it is depicted.
Well, it also came out in 1998. So to me, I enjoyed watching it now, and I also can see how many other films pull from it as inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
So it tried a lot of things, and I, like, one of the things I was going to say was one of the last movies we watched, Ben described as being creatively bankrupt. I think we all remember what movie that was. It was Battle Los Angeles.
It was Battle
Los
Angeles.
Thanks for reminding us, Lana. That was...
Yeah. And so one thing you can definitely not say about this film is that it was creatively bankrupt, because the people who worked on this film had a vision and they had ideas and they went for them. And it was fun to watch. Like, it was...
I what I liked about it was that I didn't know what to expect next.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it didn't feel like it followed the exact same formula that so many other movies follow. Like, I really never knew what the next scene was going to be. I didn't know if this was a love story. I didn't know if this was, like, a career story or a life story or what.
It was kind of a lot.
It was all
yeah. It was a lot.
And I think in an interesting way, like, this almost feels like the product of a young creative who is ultimately, like, flush with ideas, but ultimately doesn't know how to depict them because they don't have the experience of developing a story or how to develop a story or how a story should be told. And so ultimately they have, like, the ideas in place to tell a great story, but don't actually have the tools to craft that story as it should be told. And it ends up being more of a learning point or a stepping stone to greater stories later on. And so it just feels like a very fresh product that is messy because it is early on in that person's career.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying this is specifically on the director. I think there is a lot of creative people that touch this product and had influence. Yeah. And
yeah.
had influence on this film itself that they then took the learnings from this film while recognizing probably later on that like this wasn't their best work, but learning from this film mm-hmm. and allowing them to hone their craft later on and find something worthwhile.
We were also talking about the fact that this film had a, for the time, very good soundtrack, which kind of, for the time, Andre.
Well, it had a good score. For the time, it had a good score. That far away.
1998 is almost 20 years ago, dude.
Yes, but I don't think like film history has gone leaps and bounds to...
But what I'm saying is...
Like, there were good soundtracks back in 1998.
No, but what I'm saying is that there have been other movies that came out that have not been, like, critically acclaimed, like Fifty Shades of Grey, the Twilight series, which have critically acclaimed scores and soundtracks.
Because like, very popular.
Very popular. Like, they get Beyonce and The Weeknd and Death Cab to make Lana songs for them. Lana Del Rey. And so their soundtracks are very good and very well known, even though the movies are quite bad, quite poor. And I would not say that this movie was quite bad, but what I'm saying is that it set the stage for a genre of film to curate these like playlists that are actually their soundtracks. Mm-hmm. And that's also like, it's a cool thing that I think this film helped spark.
Yeah, I would agree. And I would say actually the sound, how they used the soundtrack in this film.
There
was
a couple good
like
moments.
Listening to the soundtrack on its own may not be necessarily the
wouldn't recommend
greatest.
It.
We did do it today.
Wouldn't recommend it.
Especially in 2017. I bet in 1998, like all those songs were popping because you're listening to Chris Cornell and rock.
I mean,
and
no, not Chris Cornell, but when I walked in,
no,
today,
Chris
you guys were listening to Take Back Sunday.
It got us to a place.
All American Rejects, I
yeah,
think.
All right,
yeah.
All right.
We were
no, wait,
listening.
No, when you actually walked in, yeah, I think that was Take Back.
Okay, but we went on our own musical journey that had nothing to do with
yeah.
this film.
Uh-huh.
That was our choice.
Yes.
It was quite the journey.
It was fun.
What about Green? What was that all about, huh?
What? Let's. How about we open this up
I'm
to
not,
everyone's
I'm
theory?
Not clear on it. I have
I'm
no
not
theory.
Either.
Do you have
I,
any
I have
theory?
Nothing. I tried so hard, Ben.
Okay.
Like, I really did, and I could not find a consistency that I could
yeah.
latch on.
Francis?
At first I thought it represented, like, a naivete and hope, but then toward the end,
it like
kind
comes
of
back.
That
yeah, when it comes back.
I don't know. Yeah.
I was thinking it was like creativity, but it didn't really match up one to one with.
Yeah. I think it was a situation where the director and the cinematographer had a very like strong creative idea that did not necessarily mesh with the narrative overall.
Hmm.
I could see that.
It was aesthetically pleasing. I will say that.
Yeah. And I think to that point, I think my idea of what the green represents has changed over time. When I was in high school and I first saw this film and was kind of really enthralled with it enough to eventually buy it, I was convinced that the green meant something in this film. Mm. But ultimately, I believe that is more an aesthetic decision just to get across how a film should look and that we shouldn't necessarily always, like, the color of a film doesn't always necessarily mean something. Now, if I were to take that and say, like, hey, it does mean something, I would say it's, like, his idea of love and for Estella as a person and how that comes and goes, depending on if he feels like he is being molded into needing to love her versus his actual love for her. Like, when he is at his gallery opening and it is the reintroduction of his love for that character because he can only think about her and is constantly asking about her whereabouts at the gallery. That is his true love for the idea of Estella, and it is thus the reintroduction of Green as a whole.
Yeah, I think kind of like a semi-related point, I think both Ben and Andre, while we were watching the film, brought up the idea of the green light at the end of The Great Gatsby.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I think that maybe has some influence on the symbolism of green in this film, especially because I think there's, like, an idea of, like, new money and artifice in this film that does relate to The Great Gatsby, even though
this is allegedly based on Great Expectations by Charles Dickens.
I knew I recognized that name. Okay.
Yeah, but like clearly it takes some very generous creative liberties.
I do think the like another movie that comes to mind that had a very specific color scheme was Minority Report.
Okay.
And I think
not a good color scheme.
No, I was gonna say I think this film pulled it off much better.
I think of Wes Anderson when I think of color schemes in movies.
Yeah,
like he doesn't.
But he usually has a scheme where this was green.
Yeah.
No, I mean this is green and gray.
Yeah, okay.
Like it sorry. Francis.
Oh, no. You can finish your thought.
No, I was just saying that, like, there is more of a color scheme where, sure, Wes Anderson's films are introduced to three different colors. Mm-hmm. This is a little more closely related and hews closely with green and gray while introducing some it's red
kind of monochromatic
moments.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I was just going to ask if the three of you have seen Never Let Me Go.
Not yet. I need to.
It's a
Andrew
very,
Garfield.
Yes.
I think Spider-Man. I read the book.
Yes, I saw it.
Because it was about the
yes.
Clone?
Yeah.
Oh my
yes.
God,
so,
I cried so much.
Did we see the movie?
We did see it. We saw it right after I read the book because I got really, like, the book made me really sad and then I was like, I want to watch the movie.
Maybe jog my memory. I don't know. What were you thinking with it?
Think of Spider-Man. potential crying.
Hair blowing the wrong way.
Is either running. He's either like running along a street or riding in
a
car.
He's running down a dock at one point. Yeah. But in my limited film history memory, Never Let Me Go has the strongest like color palette outside of like a Wes Anderson movie. Like I feel like Wes Anderson's color palettes are much more overt.
Is it also like a dark green and gray?
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Okay.
So it's like there are essentially four acts in the movie, and each act has a different color scheme.
Mm.
That sounds right. It's been a while since I've seen it.
This is sacrilege, especially as a person who is a writer professionally.
Francis.
I like the movie better than the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Man, I don't remember anything about the
movie,
I like the book.
And usually that's not the case for me, and I'm not a writer, but, like, usually I'm like, you know, they didn't do the book justice for these reasons, but...
Jeez. I mean, I read it, like, more than 4 years ago. I just don't remember much.
You read it a long time ago.
You
read it before me, and even then you were like, I don't remember it, and then we watched the movie
It's about
together.
All I got. It's about all
I mean,
I got
it's essentially,
on it.
Like, the emo version of The Island.
Yeah,
ooh.
That's a great... That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
island,
yeah, yeah. Now,
the
actually,
island
that helps.
The
that's actually
and the island
helpful.
Also had a color scheme. It was
yeah.
white.
Yeah.
It was white.
I don't mean to get us off track, but that's just
okay.
what I thought of in talking about color schemes.
And a little bit of The Giver, huh?
Mm,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
You got to read this book, Ben. Or watch the movie, I guess.
The Giver, the movie?
I read the book.
Well,
I think we've all read the book.
Yeah.
I think that was essential reading in, like, third grade or something
like
that?
Yeah.
I read it in like sixth.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It may not have been third grade. It might have been fourth or fifth.
I think it was fourth for me. Anyway, what about Great Expectations?
We were talking about color schemes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, hey, there was a color scheme.
I can see the green being wanting. Like, because that kind of goes with what you're saying. That kind of goes with the Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
Kind of like wanting.
Something at the end of a dock that you can never actually reach, but is always there and is something that you are... want to have and to yearn after and like want and is always in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Something that can't be reached. Yeah, I could totally see that. Which is like makes sense. It's not necessarily exciting, but it doesn't necessarily need to be either. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a Great Expectation.
Great Expectations.
I'm glad we watched it.
Did it,
yeah,
it
was
did
good.
It live up to our expectations?
Did
we talk about expectations? I didn't have any.
I didn't either. I mean, I knew there was going to be a lot of green, but I didn't know there was going to be this much green.
There was a lot of green.
I enjoyed it more than I expected to, I guess. I had
me too.
Expectations.
Especially
so
considering it's like 35% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Is
oh,
that
really
the score?
Hmm.
Yeah. It's not considered a great film, but I think there's a lot of interesting things.
I could see critics being annoyed with it.
Yeah.
So, do you guys want to know? Oh, sorry. That was probably bad for audio. I broke the tab on my beer. apologies for the listeners. Do you want to know?
For those of you,
it's live action.
Yeah,
it's real, coming into you in cinema 3D.
My embarrassing expectation for this
was,
I forgot this was not written by Jane Austen.
Oh, this would be a very different film and novel if it were written by Jane Austen.
Yeah.
Jeez. If we were all a little more, with the exception of Francis, if we were all a little more well-read in both Charles Dickens and Jane Austen to be able to riff.
We have such a literary conversation.
I know, to be able to riff on the idea of what The Great Expectations, but written by Jane Austen was.
Yeah.
We could have a great segment right here.
We could.
I'm just imagining how humorous it would be.
It'd be
yeah,
so
but also enlightened.
So good.
And also,
also
intellectual. Very intellectual.
Yeah.
I mean, because we just understand the oeuvre of both Charles Dickens and Jane Austen to their full extent. 100%.
But can you imagine if it was Jane Austen?
Honestly, probably a better film.
I mean, I can imagine it because I know Jane so well.
Yeah.
We're on a first
name. Oh, you're
basis.
On a first name basis.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Like, just imagine the entire Estella character would just have...
So different.
Yeah. There'd be a certain complexities and also, like...
So sassy and anachronistic.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's what Jane
That's
would
Jane
do.
In a nutshell.
So this is a good bit.
Yeah.
Should we just keep this going?
Yes
and...
Yeah.
No, but I do like that idea. That's funny, Francis.
It is.
I think that's a...
I saw the title card, like, based on a novel by Francis.
And that's when you knew all of your
that's
expectations
funny.
Were wrong.
It just
wrong.
All comes crashing down.
Yeah.
Those great expectations you have were all of a sudden maybe
it
not
crashed
as
in like the first minute.
Great.
That's too bad.
I saw this film before I read the book, and this film actually prompted me to end up reading Great Expectations.
How does it compare to the book?
Yeah, should we read
what
the
is,
book?
Yeah, I don't know nothing about the book. Tell
how
me.
Long
remember,
is
it? It's a pretty quick read.
Quick read? Okay.
But I also don't remember much about it.
Okay.
So clearly it left an impression.
I was about to ask if it takes place in the same era, but like obviously it can't.
It was futuristic. Yeah,
there's
it was
some
a
pretty
very
large
futuristic
differences,
book.
And like it doesn't.
It was
the same
it was kind of
ending.
Scary how well he predicted the New York subway system. It was like,
Charles was on point.
He was Charlie. Yeah.
Yeah, Charlie.
Oh, Charlie.
He's so imaginative.
Yeah, man.
I do have one. I like one question / bit that I want everyone to. Riff off of on a little bit, and it's the idea of, would you rather be rich but a hack, or would you rather be talented and poor?
Okay, a couple clarifying questions.
Let's hear it.
What am I a hack at?
Anything you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
like painting, drawing,
yeah, any
just
of those?
My job in general.
I would say lean into more the creative
something
arts
creative.
Something
creative
like arts. Looking forward and something you would imagine yourself being very cultured.
Okay,
and,
so
like you
I
could
think,
be the greatest dancer in the world.
Yeah,
well,
so
yeah.
I'm pretty sure I would choose rich and a hack
mm-hmm.
because I've always wanted to be a pop star.
Oh.
And I have a horrible voice,
uh-huh.
like truly, truly bad. And I think with today's technology.
Auto-tune. Mm-hmm.
I could
yeah.
hack it.
Auto-tune's still
to
really
get,
hot.
To get to go out and perform and hack it and make money would be, I'd be happy.
Mm.
That would be enough for me.
Yeah. That would be enough. How rich do you get in this scenario?
You are an A-lister.
A-lister. So I'm rich and famous.
Yeah.
And then what's the other option?
You are extremely talented, but poor.
Mm.
Like, you can go, in my case, I could go to karaoke and be amazing, but I'd make no money off of it. Dude, I'd choose rich and a hack.
Yeah.
Choose rich and a hack, too, just because, you know, my credit score needs some improvement.
Yeah.
Life.
Ooh. Oof. Yeah, I think so.
Oh my god, are we all going to choose Rich Dad Hack?
Well, Ben still has a chance.
Yeah, I still am chilling. I also think this is, like, oddly enough, inspired by a Kanye West lyric that I can't find right now, but I think he says something
I saw you on your phone, and I wasn't sure if you were looking something up or about to play Despacito, and I was going to remind you.
Damn,
like,
we don't have the rights.
We don't have the rights for that.
No, I think this is, like, off of a song on Watch the Throne where Kanye West is like, would you rather be rich and famous or something like that, or talented, but I can't find it right now.
We're talented and poor.
I mean, unfortunately, in our current society and how
money is
wealth, like how wealth works, I would rather be rich and known to be a hack than poor and famous and ultimately a unknown. Now, let me add a different component to that.
Okay.
If you, 100 years later, you are found to be extremely talented and your name is risen up in the likes of maybe like Nick Drake or Van Gogh, things like that.
So
does that change your answer?
Nick Drake the musician or Nick Drake the sculptor?
Musician. Musician. Who died and then his tapes were spread around and now he has a certain amount of famousness to his name. Does that change your answer?
I don't think humanity's going to last for more than the next 200 years, so no.
Fair.
Hashtag bleak.
Fair.
I don't know, I don't get to enjoy any of that.
That's
fame.
True. But it's the idea of...
Yeah.
Hey,
planting seeds in a garden you
never get to see.
Yeah, we're bad.
History has its
children, that's where it comes down to. What kind of world do you want to leave for your progeny?
Yeah,
but if you're rich and a hack, aren't you still leaving something good for your progeny?
Yeah,
true.
Yeah.
Like I don't think Van Gogh had any very specific progeny in which his name now benefits them in some way. I could be wrong. I am completely shocked.
Should we call them? Should we ask?
Yeah.
I feel like there would be a BuzzFeed article about them if
the Van Gogh
kids. Here's what the Van Gogh kids look like today.
Yeah.
You won't believe.
Yeah.
I'm
still
keeps
rich
the same
and a
answer.
Hack.
I
really want to be a pop star deep down. I'll never get to do it. But I'd like to.
In this fantasy, you can.
Yeah, so I'm gonna choose that.
I mean, sure.
I'm gonna choose my dream.
This is a relatively like bleak question because we all end up choosing
the more like bankrupt one.
No,
yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Nah, well,
no, but I understand like the difficulty around that question. Like I think unfortunately it's like an uneven question because the difficulty is like how you're personally.
Well, we're all millennials,
right.
And I think
we live in a capitalist society.
And
yeah.
I think a lot
yeah.
of millennials also suffer from imposter syndrome when they're in offices with people that are 10, 20 years more experienced than them. And so it's totally natural to be like, I would rather, like, have the money and, like, you know, be successful than continue to, like, suffer from imposter syndrome and feel like every day I'm going into my job and, like, hacking it.
Mm-hmm.
And just waiting for someone to call me out and be like, you actually don't know what you're doing, do you? You know?
You're getting really real right now.
Yeah.
Like,
dude, imposter syndrome is tough.
Leanna, come on now. This is like my everyday experience of like, I'm just waiting until someone realizes that.
No, I am too. Like, I'm literally waiting for someone to come to my desk and be like, you have no idea what you're talking about. And I will have to be like, you know?
You're not wrong.
You're not wrong.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, the one thing I find comfort in, if any of our listeners out there are also suffering from imposter syndrome,
call in and tell us your stories. Yeah.
Everyone has it. Like, that was one of the things I realized going into my MBA program was that everyone has imposter syndrome. Everyone was like, I can't believe I got in. I can't believe we're all here.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, we are. We out here. It's miracle season. Francis got that.
Yeah. I don't know if we have the rights to that one either.
He probably did trademark it.
He probably did.
Damn
it's
it.
On a t-shirt.
Bachelor Nation.
That was a fun bit. That was a fun bit.
You know what I'm disappointed with?
What?
The lack of actual use in Great Expectations.
Of as the phrase Great Expectations.
Throughout this entire podcast. Like, I called Andre. I specifically called on you. Lacking. Of all people.
You had great expectations for me.
I had incredible expectations for you.
I'm sorry.
Like, you were...
We even talked strategy.
Solid all day. Yeah,
well,
like,
I was
you had that
down.
Grape expectation
the
joke.
The grape expectations one was pretty good.
Which would have probably worked really great on the podcast.
There was one earlier today when Ben ended a sentence with great, and then I started a sentence with expectations.
Mm-hmm.
That like was amazing.
Another great one.
Yeah.
Expectations were high for this podcast.
Yeah.
Worked.
Yeah.
They were definitely high for this podcast.
I guess I ran out of ideas early on. There's only so many ways you can say great expectations.
You flamed out a little too fast.
Yep.
Yeah.
Too fast, too furious.
Should we just end this?
I guess so.
Put us out of our misery, Ben.
Yeah.
No, like, I think I had another segment.
Let's hear it.
Hold on, let me check my notes.
Like, it's
okay. There's a couple things I want to talk about.
Let's hear it.
One.
Because you were writing notes.
I took notes.
One thing I like about you, Lena, is that you always write notes during these films.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So one thing I want to talk about. Like, I think we can, we've done the critical part of this podcast. Like, let's move on and have some fun.
Okay.
One thing I want
to
talk
about
is how many times they took a shot and then tilted it, like 40 degrees.
Ooh. Yeah, maybe a little seasick.
There's actually a name for this. Andre, do you remember what it was?
Well, I think it's like a Dutch shot or a Dutch angle.
A Dutch angle. That was it. They use Dutch angles all the time. It's very disorienting.
And I had to wonder if, like, there was a reason. Like, was that the subjective idea of, like, shooting a scene?
Like, I don't
know. Because they loved it.
I don't remember 1998 enough to know if that was just a thing in 98.
Yeah.
Andre?
Well, I thought it was part of his memory being unreliable. That's how I was reading it. It was like a kind of a...
It's supposed to show that it's a little, like, unstable.
Wobbly, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, I could see that.
It could also be the impact and influence of the fairy on his experience in those moments. Mm. Because I feel like oftentimes they were either around Estella or around the fairy.
That's true. That is true. Another thing that they did all the time was these quick cuts.
Oh.
And sometimes
which were a little distracting and some like it was
seriously.
Like slow down a little bit.
Yeah.
Sometimes they were just cuts and other times they were crossfades.
Yes.
Like
which took just a little too long to actually
almost might as well have been a star wipe.
Yeah.
I know. It brought me back to
Star Wars.
Yeah.
I love that they still do that in the new movies too.
It's great.
Like the really cheesy wipes.
It's very good.
Man.
Yeah.
It was really uncomfortable when they would do that with like young Stella. All
the
different
That's
the cuts
one
of her body.
Like, yeah, ooh. They did like a couple of crossfades to like her neck, her lips, her ears. Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, the idea of sexualization of a child is never okay and always uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely focused on that between like showing the nape of her neck or her licking her lips.
Or just like a real tight close up of like. The two kids making out in the fountain.
Yeah.
Like, kids are going to kiss. I'm okay with kids kissing. I felt weird as an adult watching kids kiss.
It was set up in a way that
and it was,
was purposely
it was those
meant
quick
to be sexual.
Shots, like,
yeah.
Like, look at their tongues. Look at them. Keep looking. There they are again.
Yeah.
Closer.
I mean, yeah, it would have been different if it had been shot from a distance. Like, it would have felt like more of a normal, like, childhood experience of, like, everyone has an awkward makeout.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I think we see the awkward first kiss of kids in films a lot.
Yeah.
And you don't usually feel uncomfortable because you're like, oh, kids, so cute. But,
yeah.
Like, this one
was
definitely
was...
like,
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. Should I be here for this?
It's a little awkward.
Probably not.
Follow-up question. Are you now interested in trying the fountain kiss with significant others? You
absolutely
have.
Not.
No,
I'm gonna pass.
Oh, that
really?
Doesn't sound interesting.
No, I'm gonna make a hard
no,
pass.
Drink of the same water. What you don't want backwaters? Like, what are you getting out of a kiss?
Yeah, that's definition.
Like, if
right
anything,
there.
Like
it's
a fountain kind of like cleanses that
I mean,
backwash.
If I'm going to a fountain, I just want some clean water. I'm going to satiate my thirst, my genuine thirst, not my sexual thirst.
There's a lot of
why not do both
as well.
Mm-hmm.
Why not do both at the same time?
I don't like the double dip.
Speaking of thirst,
I think the director just told Ethan Hawke, like, your only job is to just look thirsty. Like, thirsty for money, thirsty for your paintings to be successful, thirsty for Gwyneth, thirsty for
the number of times he, like, licks his lips or is just, like, looking parched because his mouth is, like, somewhat agape. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
there were some shots where, like, he had, like, some scabs on his lip. Like,
so thirsty. Oh, poor boy.
I know. He was the thirstiest boy.
Yeah.
Ben, you had a great line. You said something like, thirst embodied.
Yeah, yeah. He has captured the idea of thirst visualized in all the aspects of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, if you don't know what thirsty means, watch this film. You will know by the end of it.
That's actually where the phrase came from. He's looking thirsty.
It actually came from queer people of color, but you know.
Well,
I don't want to be the one to create a revisionist history on this.
Okay.
But I like the idea of it, Andre.
My bad.
No. they're erased enough that we don't need to erase them on this podcast.
The other thing I wanted to talk about was just life in 1998.
Yes.
Mm. Man.
Specifically the fact that you could smoke in restaurants and also... there was a scene where they were in an airport and they were just hanging out like in a terminal. That's also something like you can't right do by anymore.
The departure gate.
Yeah.
Where was everyone in 1998 to start this off?
I was in Portland.
Salem.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. In 1998,
you two are mobile.
I was in Texas, Southern Texas, Corpus Christi, on a military base.
I was probably in Tokyo at that point. I think I moved to Tokyo in 97, so I was definitely in Tokyo at this point. So all in very different locations.
Yeah. I don't really remember much specifically about 1998. There was probably an election that year.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Is that, am I doing my...
But also at that point, like our idea of, at least for me, I had no idea of like... politics. And,
no, I don't think it was until the following election that I started to hear what was going on.
Was that Clinton or Bush?
It was Bush.
Bush.
Okay.
He was elected again.
Yeah, in 2002. I don't know, just 1990. Oh, also the other thing was the suits that people wore.
That's very loose and flowy. It was nice. Flowy. Yeah.
So Hank Azaria is in this film. None of us have mentioned that yet. And he wears a very loose suit. And that got us to Googling the NBA draft in 1998.
Which is
and
just
those boys the best. Had some choice suits.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe that was the style.
If you've never Googled 1998 NBA draft suits, you are missing out. That's
like
the thing that you should do.
Zoot suits, but worse.
Yeah.
And so like style and fashion are just such an interesting thing and how it changes over time.
Yeah.
And how like to us now, those suits are like the most ill-fitting suits I think I have ever laid eyes upon.
And they're tall boys.
They're already big men.
It's hard. I get
very
that.
Tall boys.
Like their jackets are going to be longer than other boys. I understand that.
Yeah, but they don't have to fall lower on their own bodies.
But they don't have to, like they're already 6'8". Like they don't need to add an additional...
The jackets go down almost
shorter,
to their knees, like mid
thigh.
Yeah.
It makes them look like they're just like a small kid.
Here's
in
the other thing, though.
Yeah.
They don't need to wear pants made for a 6'11" boy if they're 6'8". They don't need the extra 3 inches, but they all have it. They all have those.
You
got to
cover up those shoes a little bit.
Yeah.
You never know.
It's so silly.
Well, you can always take it up, but you can't. That you can't let them back down, you know?
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
You
so, future proof.
Like, that's a good point.
Future proof.
Like, there's enough cloth on those suits to, like, make two cloths for a normal person.
Do you think that's what they all thought when they bought the suits? Like, this is great. There's so much fabric here. I can make it last forever.
Well, should I get the longer one or the shorter one? Well, you can always take it up.
That's just practical.
Yeah, it is practical.
That's practicality.
Wow.
At
you
work.
Know, this whole time I've been making fun of them, but it sounds like the boys that were.
Well, you don't, and you also don't know. You never know if you're done growing. Like these guys have been growing for a while.
Yeah, that's true.
You might have one more spurt.
Let's make hashtag futureproof happen.
Yeah, and like have it become like a style movement. These extra long pants hashtags futureproof.
I don't know. We'll see what we can do.
Camo comes back into style. Hashtag futureproof. We're going to make gas masks happen. Hashtag futureproof.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused about what future-proof means at this point.
Oh, I'm preparing for the apocalypse.
Oh, got it.
Okay. Okay, got
I'm
it.
Ready yeah. for Mad
Makes
Max.
Sense. Makes sense.
The yeah. Mad Max world to happen.
Yeah, we might be going into nuclear war next week, so.
Give me Imperator Franciosa, and we're there. We're ready.
Is that
I hope
guitar-
you're ready to, like,
is
take
that. Guitarist?
That- I hope, no, Imperator Furiosa is, but this is
oh,
Imperator
okay.
Franciosa.
Oh, good one.
With her nice. Selection, nice. With Zoe writing and shotgun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad is a survival instructor. I have 2 weeks of survival supplies in my closet.
I mean, I know Smart. Where I'm going when the earthquake hits, at least. I know I'm going to be dead weight to Francis, but I know where I'm
but
going.
I'm showing up.
But you're
I'll
so
be
much,
there.
You're so much taller than me. You just have to look intimidating.
I can
get one
that,
of those big
think.
Suits, and then you'll look really big. And they're future proof.
Hashtag future proof.
Extra fabric for you can like turn them into gloves and
tourniquets.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You oh, shelter.
And, yeah, shelter.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So he's referencing The Office.
That's actually yeah what I was thinking of, the one where Michael
he like rips his pant legs off because it's too hot, but then he has to tape them back on because it gets too cold. It's very good.
It's really
not, I'm not familiar enough with The Office to necessarily understand that.
It's we're right. way off topic.
It's,
right. It's okay.
We're like over an hour. We could even call
sure
it.
Did
you have
almost like you
segment?
Want to?
No, I'm good.
Close
we talked
up.
About all the things I had notes on.
And with that, that has been another episode of the Munch Podcast. This was my birthday Super Munch post in which we watched Great Expectations, directed by the same director as Children of Men, Gravity, and The Prisoner of Azkaban. And if you want to get in contact with us, email us at getmunchedup@gmail.com. We would love to answer your questions, comments, or anything else you have to say. You can find us on Twitter at Get Munched Up. Instagram is also Get Munched Up. Pinterest, Get Munched Up. Facebook, you can find us at Munch Blog, or I think also just look for Get Munched Up. I'm sure you can find us.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook
yeah.
is just a weird one, and
it
the search never
one.
Works out well.
No.
And finally, we post all of our content and put a lot of our work into the meals we develop for these movies and pair with these movies and the photos we shoot for them. So head to getmunchedup.com to find information about that because we put a lot of effort into those and I think we're all very proud of how those turn out. And one final question, what is your unexpected artistic goal in life that is outside of what you're like Francis, you can't be a novelist. I'm going to say that right now.
Okay. You look so disappointed. Damn it.
I have one in mind.
But I want to hear everyone's unexpected artistic endeavor. If some benefactor entered into your life and made you a superstar, pop star doesn't
I mean,
work for
sure
you.
It doesn't?
No.
Oh, it has to be outside of that.
Yeah.
I would learn to play the piano then.
Okay.
I could teach you basic scales.
I know basics. I took piano like
oh, you
kindergarten
be
through
okay.
fourth grade, but I was very bad at it and didn't
me.
Practice, and I regret that. Like it'd be great. It'd be great.
To yeah, but you don't understand play. That as a kid.
No, you don't. So that's what I would do. And like, if I could get the voice lessons on the science, so I could like sing along and like you know
turn
be
yourself
be
into
Lady
a pop
Gaga.
Star.
Yeah,
oh,
like,
I see how it
that.
Is.
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. Francis.
I want to make a perfect scone.
All right. That's nice. I'd enjoy a perfect scone.
Yeah, that's rewarding. Come back to me. I don't know.
All right. I will go with dance. I'd love to be like a modern dancer. Not necessarily ballet, but more like interpretive / modern dancing.
I thought woodworking would be fun. You just need also actually beer brewing is something I really wanted to do. I just don't have the space.
The art of beer brewing.
Yeah.
I
what
feel
would
like
you
what? Could do beer brewing and woodworking in the same space.
Oh man, like a
that
wooden
would be the real dream.
Oh,
actually, the guy who built my parents'
I just need a
dining
garage.
Room table,
I need a shop.
He is a woodworker and he also brews cider.
Yeah, very cool. He's living the dream.
He is living the dream.
Almost.
Your dream.
Needs hops instead of
specifically on
yeah.
the White's dream.
My next house will have a shop.
What ingredients will you put into your beer.
All the ones, the hops, the wheat, the...
No, I mean
all
like... It, outside of like the typical, like if you had to infuse it with a fruit or a spice or something like that, what would you put into it to call it the Andre Wyatt original?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
It could be a collection too.
I could do... Oh, it's not that original, but I like oak, you know, kind of like that barrel aged flavor. I love that. I love that. That's always always the beers I'm drawn to. So, and then you know I'm woodworking, so I could make my own barrels.
Yeah,
and I think you look so happy.
Yeah,
I'm imagining like the logo and everything now, and it's probably just called the Silver Bullet.
Yeah, right? That'd be great.
Silver Bullet Brewing.
That'd be great.
Silver Bullet instead of Brewing. Silver City Brewing.
Exactly.
Yep.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
That's been the episode. Good day.